The Guardian. A little over 10 years ago, there was a spate of thefts from American Ivy League universities. Former Harvard researchers were jailed for alleged theft from their old laboratory. Over 100 vials and Petri dishes were found in an ex-Cornell University researcher's luggage at the airport. And then, a former Brown University doctoral student reportedly broke into a lab where he'd worked, deleting files and stealing antibodies. The Brown student later said he didn't want someone else to take credit for his work. Science is driven by a curiosity to understand a piece of the world and get there first. Researchers want publications in top journals, the kudos and the prestige that follows. So you can see why competition in science might be intense. But is rivalry necessary?
Competition is very good for science because as soon as there's competition, the field really took off. But it's terrible for scientists.
In his new book, The Gene Machine, Sir Venki Ramakrishnan describes the race to uncover a fundamental component of our cells, the ribosome. We invited him to talk about his experience, from the rivalry involved to winning the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, and then being elected the President of the Royal Society. We ask him whether he thinks competition is necessary for science to flourish. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
I'm Venki Ramakrishnan, and I'm a group leader at the MRC Laboratory for Molecular Biology in Cambridge. And I'm also the current president of the Royal Society.
Venki actually began his career in physics, not biology. He studied in India before picking up his PhD from Ohio University.
And unfortunately, I found myself working on a problem that I had very little interest in. And it also seemed to me that I didn't actually have a lot of interest in what was going on in physics at the time. But when I read articles in Scientific American, I was always fascinated by how things were taking off in biology. So I decided to go to graduate school all over again after my PhD at University of California in San Diego in order to learn biology because I didn't know any biology. And so I even took undergraduate classes, even though I had a PhD. You can do that in the U.S., you know, where some universities are flexible enough. And as a result, I acquired a background in biology. And then as a result of another Scientific American article, I stumbled into working on the ribosome in Peter Moore's lab at Yale.
Tell us a little bit about the ribosome before we talk a bit more about your research career. But tell us a bit about what it was about this structure that fascinated you. And what is a ribosome? What does it do?
Yeah, it's a good question, because when I switched over to biology, I had a vague idea of what DNA was, like everybody else. But I had no idea of what a ribosome was. I'd never heard of it. If you think of what DNA is, it's essentially a store of our genetic information. But what genes are essentially sections of DNA, and most of them contain information on how to make a protein. And there are, of course, thousands of proteins in every one of our cells, and they do all sorts of things. For example, the reason you can hear me is because of proteins in your ears, and the reason you can see something is because of proteins in your eyes. Virtually everything in life depends on proteins. And each protein is made using instructions stored in a gene that resides on DNA. And what happens is that this section of DNA is copied into a temporary molecule called messenger RNA. You can think of it as a long tape containing a sequence of instructions. And what the ribosome is a large molecular complex. You can think of it as a molecular machine. And it latches onto this tape and starts reading it and then starts making the protein that's specified by that tape.
So how much did we know about this when you started your research? And what was the big question that you were trying to tackle?
Yeah, so the ribosomes were discovered in the late 50s. And a lot of work had been done by the time I joined the field, which was in the late 70s. And so people knew that the ribosome consists of two halves, and one half read the genetic message, and the other half actually stitched together the protein chain. So a lot of facts were known. But imagine, you know, this is a huge machine, and nobody had any idea what it looks like. So it's a little bit like if you were a Martian, and you were hovering above the Earth, and you saw these little objects move around in straight lines and occasionally turn at right angles. And then you get a bit closer and you start doing some measurements on them and you say, oh yes, they seem to take in gasoline and emit carbon dioxide and water and some pollutants. You still have no idea what this machine was or how it actually worked. But then when you opened it up and you saw the engine and how it was connected through a crankshaft to the steering wheel and to the wheels and so on, then you would have an understanding of how a car worked. And it's very much the same with a molecule like the ribosome. And often in science, just seeing has led to tremendous advances, you know, with telescopes and planets led to our understanding of the solar system. Being able to see cells with a microscope changed biology completely. So at every stage, being able to see more detail has really advanced science in a big way.
And what was standing in the way of seeing the ribosome, as it were, of getting to grips with that structure? Was there something which changed which made that possible?
Yeah, so the traditional way of solving atomic structures, that is, visualizing atomic structures of large molecules, it was a technique called X-ray crystallography. This is a technique whereby you coax your molecules to form very regular three-dimensional arrays. And of course, if you have a simple molecule like salt or sugar, any school child can do it. You know, you make a solution and let it evaporate and you get crystals. Okay. But if you have a very large molecule, they tend to be quite floppy and very difficult to coax into three-dimensional crystals. And a big breakthrough was made around 1980 when the larger part of the ribosome has two halves, but one of them is twice as large as the other. So the large subunit, as they call it, was actually crystallized by Ara Jonath, who was working in Heinz Gunther Wittmann's institute. And then a few years later, a group in Russia crystallized both the small subunit as well as the entire ribosome. So in the late 90s, eventually things took off.
Often the way that science is portrayed is, you know, sort of light bulb moment and aha, I've cracked it, you know, eureka. Did you have that feeling when you were doing your work? Or was it, because I know like trying to decipher crystal structures is sort of just a very long, hard slog. Was there a moment?
Oh, no, there were several eureka moments.
There were?
So the first is when you get crystals that are good enough quality that when you stick them in an X-ray beam, you see a huge number of spots. That tells you that their quality is good enough to get an atomic structure. So that was a big eureka moment.
That's other is champagne bottle number one.
and then the other one is when you are trying to figure out whether you can get some certain special atoms bound to the structure, and you're looking for the signal from these special atoms. And when you see that, and that's usually after a long, grueling data collection trip at a synchrotron where you haven't slept for 48 hours, and then when you see that calculation and you see those peaks from the special atoms, then you know that in principle you're going to be able to calculate a three-dimensional map of the object and then slowly build a structure. So that's another big eureka moment.
These eureka moments eventually won him the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, together with Thomas Stites and Ada Jonath. They were jointly awarded it for studies of the structure and function of the ribosome.
Well, I wasn't expecting it because you don't just get the Nobel Prize out of the blue. There are lots of run-up prizes, and the Swedes also invite you to lots of meetings, and they want to take a look at you to make sure, you know, you're not a complete mistake. So anyway, at one of these meetings, there was a Swedish ribosome scientist who disagreed with me, and still does actually, about one aspect of how the ribosome works. And it's a very specialized aspect. Anyway, at the banquet, he came and we had this, you know, real knockdown argument. And in fact, his colleague had to come and separate us.
Oh, gosh.
And so then I found out about a few months later that he had joined the Nobel Committee for Chemistry. So I immediately dismissed it and it said, I am never going to get the Nobel Prize because there's no way this guy will ever vote for me. And he's the only knowledgeable guy in my field on that committee. So just one word from him is going to sink me, right? So it was actually very liberating. I felt I wasn't a candidate anymore. I didn't have to campaign. I could just get on with my work. Yes, it was sort of a disappointment, but you know, it's fine. And I slowly got used to that idea. And so when the phone call came, I was very, very surprised and actually asked to speak to him. And when he came on the line, that's when I realized it was actually true.
Venky, what did your wife think when you won this?
Well, initially I couldn't get hold of her because my stepdaughter Tanya was visiting and the two of them had gone for a walk. And my wife didn't use a mobile. She still almost never uses a mobile phone. And so I couldn't get hold of her. Eventually, I got hold of her, and she said, I thought you had to be really smart to win one of those.
Oh, dear.
And I say that, well, the Canadian Prime Minister Lester Pearson's wife, I believe Marion Pearson, is quoted as saying, behind every successful man is a very surprised woman.
After the break, we talk about the pressure scientists like Venky face and ask, would a more collaborative approach be better for science and the scientists?
That stress and the fact that, you know, you might be scooped and come out second best forces you to work harder, to think harder, and, you know, to try and be as creative as you can in solving problems.
We'll be back in a minute after the break.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard about the ribosome, the machinery within a cell that helps to convert genetic information into a protein. It was understanding this structure that meant Venky shared the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2009. But at what cost? I was keen to understand what it's like to be in such a race.
Yeah, so I say in my book that competition is very good for science because as soon as there's competition, the field really took off. But it's terrible for scientists because it's extremely stressful. But on the other hand, that stress and the fact that, you know, you might be scooped and come out second best forces you to work harder, to think harder, and, you know, to try and be as creative as you can in solving problems. I mean, it's to some extent, it's the same as in any other field, including business. I mean, this is why economists like the free market, because it allows competition, it weeds out bad ideas. So it's the same, very much the same in science. But I have to say, it is tough on the people who are in the middle of it.
Did you find that took a toll on you personally, or did you find that you thrived on it?
Well, it was both. I think what you have to do is you have to step aside and try and maintain a good work-life balance. So I would always take time off, you know, go hiking or listen to music or, you know, things like that. So there are ways to cope with stress. It's not ideal, but I don't see, you know, there's a lot of ideological fervor about competition is bad and collaboration should always be the norm. And I don't believe that's the case. I think we'll always have a mixture of competition and collaboration. There are lots of cases where collaboration is the right thing and the obvious thing to do. And if that's the case, of course one should collaborate. And also, you have to remember, people will collaborate and compete at the same time, sometimes even with the same person. They'll collaborate on one aspect while competing on a different aspect.
But does that competition ever go too far? Given that researchers have been jailed for stealing science, I would say so. But this question got Venki talking about why scientists are motivated to do the research they do.
You know, scientists are motivated by lots of things. The big driver for science is curiosity, just wanting to know the answer. And another thing is maybe some people are interested in applications. Some people want to have applications that are really beneficial. Others want applications that make a lot of money. So there are all sorts of motivations for science. But one of the motivations is definitely getting recognition. Everyone wants to be thought of as good at what they do. I mean, I'm sure journalists are the same, right? I mean, you want to know, you want to be thought of by your colleagues as being really good. And that means that you've got to get there with the result, you know, or you'll be in sort of also-ran. And so I think they're just given the fact that science is done by humans, I'm not sure you can ever avoid that. We should never forget people are individuals. They're not some cogs in a wheel or robots or things like that.
So Venki, you discovered the structure, or you helped to unpick the structure of the ribosome. It was key work. You won the Nobel Prize. What next? I mean, where do you go from there? You know, you're president of the Royal Society. Is there any other accolade you want to scoop, or is it about now just finding the time for other pursuits or other areas of interest in your research?
Yeah, so I have to say, things like the Nobel Prize or what I call knock-on effects, including the Royal Society presidency, these are not really part of science. They're what you might call fringe benefits in science. It doesn't mean that your science suddenly stops. I mean, it might stop if you got the prize for something you did 20 years ago and you're now retired. Well, you haven't done any science for a while. But if you're an active scientist, there's always the next level of problems to pursue. And what we are trying to ask is, how are ribosomes regulated in the cell? How do they know where to start and when to start and how efficiently to start making proteins? How do viruses hijack our ribosomes to make their own proteins? And so there are lots and lots of problems. And one thing I do say in the book is often, you know, you're on the path to a goal and you think you're reaching a summit. But actually, when you get to the summit, you realize you've only reached a little foothill and there's a whole range of mountains that are still there, you know, before you. And Vannevar Bush, who was very influential in forming post-war U.S. science policy, referred to science as the endless frontier. So there really is no end point in science. You just keep on doing it until you're tired or you die. And then, you know, you let the next generation take over.
So Venki Ramakrishnan, thank you so much for joining us on Science Weekly.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. If you want to get in touch with us, you can. Just email scienceweekly@theguardian.com or tweet @guardianaudio. And a link to Venki's book, Gene Machine, can be found on our website, theguardian.com/podcasts. The producer was Greer Jackson. I'm Nicola Davis. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye. For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.